This is Fresh Air. Dr. Kevin Cahill has worked as a physician for more than 3 decades in Africa, Latin America, and Asia. He's treated people injured by war and natural disaster. He says he learned the humbling lessons of third world medicine, that politics and prejudice were as much a part of most nations' health problems as the diseases he was taught in medical school. Last year, he organized a conference on health and human rights in conflicts and disasters. He's edited a book of papers presented at the conference called A Framework for Survival. Dr. Cahill is president of the Center for International Health and Cooperation in New York and directs the Tropical Disease Center at Lenox Hill Hospital. He's worked in Somalia on and off since the early 60s. He was there when the American Marines landed a few months ago, and it made him think about the alternatives to military intervention.
Well, there were many alternatives. I think in the 3 years leading up to that intervention by 30,000 American troops, really very little was done to help a country that was visibly going into anarchy. We, having supported the dictator there, President Siad Barre, for many years and having supplied him with weapons, really had a hands-off operation. I actually was involved with a number of other people to try to convince our government that while we were using a military venture in the Gulf in Iraq, why could we not do a compassionate effort in Somalia, a neighboring or another Islamic country in the region? And there was no sympathy to that approach at all. So by the time we intervened in December of 92, the fact is, something had to get done. Everybody was shooting everybody in the streets, and it was clear whether we really had to send in 30,000 American troops and whether we defined our mandate, was it to just open some streets up and open a port and get food out. I think the questions that weren't answered at that time and the sort of focus maybe a little bit on the media acceptability when you see starving people on television or reading the papers, I think there's a lot of desire on the part of the administration to do somewhere at that time to do something dramatic, and they did. And they secured peace. But 6 short months later, we're being perceived by many Somalis now as an army of occupation as opposed to a relief force. And I think there were alternatives in terms of diplomacy, in terms of supporting voluntary organizations. There were certain heroic people out there, but you may recall that organizations such as Medecins Sans Frontières or the Red Cross did not want the military to come in. I mean, they've always not prided, they've just found their own work is hindered ultimately by too close an alliance with military. So that while I think the military can serve a good purpose, no one else has the helicopters, no one else has the resources for immediate intervention. The fact is, there are many other entities around that, if supported, would probably do and could have done a better job there.
As a doctor in Somalia at the time the troops landed, what were your concerns about military intervention and how it would affect your medical work?
I was in a refugee camp at the time, and frankly, when they landed Mogadishu, most of the sort of people with guns fled back into the hinterlands, and as they did that, they certainly were coming upon areas such as where we were working, where armed bands would come in and steal all the cars and take the... there were lives lost on... Not unnecessarily. I think, as I say, it was so late in the day that anything was done. No one really asked and involved many of the people who had been on the ground there for not only years, but really decades. I've been working in Somalia on and off since 1960, and there were many other people around who knew that country well, and maybe there were certain fundamental errors that we're living with now that might not have been made had they been questioned. For example, do you dignify warlords who were responsible for hundreds of thousands of deaths and make them the major figures in your conference, and then only discover 6 months later that you can't deal with them and then start all over again in a more aggressive military way? Do you spend as much money in 2 months of military operations as 3 years previously had been spent by all nations together in humanitarian efforts? Those are, I think, are the type of legitimate question that you can not only raise, but probably debate profitably so you don't make the same errors in the future.
You make the point that you think doctors can contribute in ways that politicians, soldiers, and diplomats can't. What do you think doctors can do that the others can't?
Well, occasionally physicians who have worked for long periods, or health workers, I would say, not just doctors, but I draw on my own experience there, have a type of trust in communication that is just very difficult to match in any other way. There are suspicions throughout the tropics, very often justifiable suspicions of any intervention by big powers. History has told many of the countries of Africa and Latin America that every time a big power comes in under any aegis, ultimately they're the losers. They may be coming in with large amounts of surplus food or grain and nobody plants, and so unless these things are coordinated, the next year may be worse, and people leave and they go to wherever the next focus of attention is. So that while Somalia is in the limelight now, next year it might be Angola or Mozambique, and people know this. So I think there are lessons that physicians who have had, and health workers have had, the privilege of on-the-ground long-term involvement and understand the people and are trusted very often by the people at all levels, certainly at the leadership level. I think that type of trust is not available very often in the client big power relationship that would deal, for an example, with an American diplomat and a local politician, or with a powerful American army general and a local military person.
Dr. Kevin Cahill is my guest. We're going to take a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Kevin Cahill, and he's the president and director of the Center for International Health and Cooperation in New York and director of tropical diseases at Lenox Hill Hospital in New York. He's the editor of a new book called A Framework for Survival, Health, Human Rights, and Humanitarian Assistance in Conflicts and Disasters. You're soon going to return to Somalia to establish an amputee program based on a program that you created in Nicaragua. Why an amputee program? Is this an outgrowth of the conflicts there?
Yeah, before President Siad Barre fled the country, he dropped somewhere between 2 and 4 million mines around the capital of what used to be northern Somaliland, or English Somaliland, the city of Hargeisa. And then he bombed it, and the problem with mines is that they don't just serve a military purpose. In fact, in this instance, it's doubtful they had any military purpose. They were intended to intimidate the population, and they were dropped as they were in Afghanistan, Angola, Mozambique, Nicaragua, sort of indiscriminately. And people, as in Somalia, where their primary occupation is herding camels, they go out and, as they take their camels out in the fields, they tend to blow the camels and their legs off, and it's a tragedy of the first order, and most of the victims, actually, in almost every one of the countries, are civilian, and the majority are children. And we felt that if we could get both a visible and a successful program going, that in this area of northern Somalia, where there's virtually no health services at all at this time, that we could take one specific thing and put legs back on people in significant numbers quickly. And I'm working with a technique called the Jaipur foot, based on an Indian technology of using a rubberized prosthesis that can be put on a leg in 20 to 25 minutes. And we're going to do this by bringing people from Jaipur up to northern Somalia, train the Somalis, so that it's part of a project that I, again, feel deeply about, that the Somalis must be allowed to help themselves, not just receive help from us. So this will not be legs put on by American doctors or technicians. It will be using the experiences and resources that we can bring to bear to train Somalis to put legs on other Somalis. And then when the program ends in 18 months, hopefully that rehabilitation unit would be part of a revitalized and maybe a functioning health system, which does not exist there now.
Let me move to Latin America. I think the first time you went to Nicaragua was in 1972 after an earthquake in Managua. Mm-hmm. What was it like to get there in the wake of an earthquake?
was pretty dramatic. In fact, it was very dramatic. The entire city was still quaking. I met Howard Hughes as he was leaving the airport, and I was arriving, so I'm one of the very few people who could say that. I lived in a tent with General Somoza for 2 weeks, which was an unusual experience, and I basically directed the health service of a city that had collapsed, and the principles were not difficult to imagine. You set up health services on the periphery, and you tried to get people who had been crushed or hurt in the central city. It was never quite clear how many died, but 20 to 25,000 in the earthquake. And you moved it out, and you set up health services. I later worked in an earthquake in Guatemala, where it was just the opposite. More people died, but you couldn't find them because they were out in the rural areas, and the hills just buried them down under, and the center city was all intact.
What are the typical injuries you have to treat in an earthquake?
Mainly crush injuries, you know, buildings collapsing on people and trying to find people, and the panic. And in Nicaragua, it was the corruption that surrounds a relief operation. All of the goods that were sent in were held at the airport and parceled off to various members of the Somoza family at that time. And that was, I think, the beginning of the downfall of General Somoza, because people were so just sickened by the awareness that in this great national tragedy, personal gain had become even more arrogantly a feature of that particular administration. And so during that period, I got to know many of the leaders of what emerged as the Sandinista movement. Many of them had been patients of mine even there, because it was a small country, Nicaragua, and the foreign minister, for example, Father Descoto, his mother and father were patients of mine. They had been ambassadors under Somoza, or Sergio Ramirez, a novelist whom I knew, ended up as vice president during the Ortega period. So it was all, it's a smallish country, and I think the role, again, maybe that's a wonderful example where you could serve as I have, as a physician ultimately to the Somoza and his family, and to Ortega and his family. And I don't think either one ever really, I cannot recall either one ever asking me about the other, nor would I have responded about the other. But it doesn't mean that I don't have thoughts about both, and that I could maybe share, as I have tried to in this book and in other writings, the experiences, and maybe to the benefit of my own country.
As a doctor, you want to make sure that humanitarian concerns aren't overshadowed by military concerns. In your book, you express your concerns that the United Nations' military efforts might overshadow their humanitarian efforts.
Well, this is a very interesting issue, and I think it's almost happening right before our eyes, because as the peacekeeping operations around the world increase, and these costs under the United Nations Charter are what are called mandated costs. Once the Security Council votes for them, the countries participating in the United Nations must give the contributions requested, or not requested, demanded of them for military. Whereas for humanitarian affairs, all are just voluntary. They encourage people to donate money. And there is a real syndrome called donor fatigue, or frankly, just not enough money. So if you're spending all of your money on military, the chance that you're going to be able to continue to provide voluntarily humanitarian assistance is almost zero. And it's getting worse and worse. I really believe that the United Nations, which now spends more on peacekeeping operations than the entire rest of the UN budget by about 50% more, is going to have to seriously look at what its mission is. Do we want just another army? Do we really believe that military solutions are going to be any more lasting in the next generation than they have been in the preceding 100 generations? Or should diplomats and humanitarian workers and politicians and military people not be coming together and saying, wait a minute, what can we learn out of the various conflicts and disasters that we've been facing? Where can we put a new system together and maybe truly evolve a new approach to foreign policy? And that's the theme that came out of that framework for survival symposium, which ended up in the book that you referred to, where very experienced people, Cyrus Vance, David Owen, people who no one can fault as far as their experience in diplomacy, suddenly are saying, Mr. Vance in particular is saying, there is a new diplomacy that is needed. There's a new approach that has to be understood, and then experienced humanitarian workers, as I say, tired of being sort of encouraged and partially funded, but then not listened to, is saying, wait a minute, we're the ones out there. We know what's going on, and it behooves everybody, I think, to start thinking not of little tinkering. I really believe that it's the United States really has an opportunity to have an utterly new foreign policy based on something that is closer to what the founding fathers of this country wanted.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Kevin Cahill edited the new book, A Framework for Survival. This is Fresh Air.